21 years old. Currently, his fascinations and explorations are directed toward uncovering the mysteries of life and ourselves. Of late, his spiritual interests include balancing the natural intelligence of our body, the wisdom and resourcefulness of our mind, and the feeling sense of our heart. For the past 30 years, Phil has expressed his love for truth by facilitating retreats, leading rapport sittings, serving as a TAP Foundation member, and studying with Richard Rose during 1985 to 1995. Phil and his wife live in Pennsylvania, and they were adopted by two kittens in 2013. So welcome, Phil.
Thanks, Anna. So the website for this session, I had a description, and the title was Navigating Our Spiritual Waters to the Greatest Treasure of All. And I'll just read the description that I had. So in yonder days, seafaring treasure hunters gathered resources for the journey, a sturdy ship to navigate perilous waters, supplies for sustenance, fellow explorers who offered various skills, and tools to remain on course and steer clear of rocky shores. Tools such as a compass, nautical charts, and maps of the stars. As explorers in the spiritual world, we undertake this grand journey with the hope of finding the greatest treasure of all, one that fully satisfies our desire to know who we truly are. And like ancient mariners, we face perilous waters, but our rocky shores are of a different nature. Likewise, we must muster the appropriate tools to maintain our direction. So today, I'll talk about the art of navigation and offer some navigation tools to help seekers in their grand journey inward. So in June of this year, 2017, this book was published. It's called How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain. I think Gary mentioned this in August, so it piqued my curiosity. How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain by Newberg and Waldman, so it's co-authored. And my teacher, Rose, Richard Rose, said that science will ultimately vindicate spiritual discovery. So science was always a few steps behind, in his mind, the spiritual endeavors and the discoveries that we find along the way. I don't feel like science will ever completely match or capture the mystery of all this. But to me, this book helps explain what is happening in our brain as we follow a spiritual path. And it illustrates the major changes that permanently occur in the brain during the insights that we get along the way and at the point of enlightenment. And it also explains why there's just so many different paths and kind of why they come together in the end in this state. Not a state, but an experience of enlightenment. I don't like to use that word enlightenment, but rather than dance around the issue, because there's a lot of marketing hype with the word, it's a goal. So it's a stated goal, and a goal which is truly the treasure that we are pursuing. And of course, as soon as I say anything about enlightenment or any of the speakers this weekend, it makes the pursuit into something grandiose. And I use the term lately, the grand mal enlightenment. And I had this belief not too long ago that I'd be flopping around on the floor once the state of enlightenment hit. And it's amazing these far-fetched beliefs. And you know, we could all laugh at that, but as you really look back at yourself, what do you believe enlightenment is? We all have these beliefs. And a lot of it, for me, was getting myself pumped up with books, websites, being around too many teachers. So get all this junk, basically, accumulated over time, these ideas, these beliefs. But according to the book, which I really like, we are biologically predisposed to enlightenment. That was the thesis. And I maintain that everybody has what they need to do. Everybody intrinsically has this thing that you're looking for. And nobody is incapable, nobody is lacking. Enlightenment is available to all. And in fact, it might even be hardwired into our brain. That's another point of the book. And it might be like a light bulb waiting to be energized for you to just flip the switch. So there's an everyday awareness in all of us that is intrinsic and impossible not to have. When were you never not aware? But I don't think it's particularly helpful to push a brand of enlightenment that tends to close people off. In my search, I found that those teachers that were highly opinionated tend to be the most impactful. And of course, they're going to gravitate and teach what is important to them. But if they get too locked into their technique and say that's the path that has to be followed, it really limits the seekers. There's no doubt about it, enlightenment is highly personalized, and this is what I like about TAT. You'll see several speakers here this weekend. There's a whole myriad of approaches that they have followed, and even descriptions of enlightenment, which depersonalizes it. For me, we had Richard Rose. That was the guy, that was the experience, that was the way to do it. But we have eight or 10, I don't even know that, I've never counted, but people that are deeply realized, all quite unique, and that to me is a value. So attempting to limit yourself to a narrow approach by comparing yourself to others, these are just bad ideas generally. So let me say a few words about beliefs. Our beliefs in enlightenment captivate our heart. They draw you in. And our imagination. My beliefs fueled my love of truth, no doubt about it. But eventually this journey turns into what I would call bait and switch. That's the bait. Those beliefs end up anchoring us in the mind. The mind is useful and creative, but it has its limitations, especially in relation to true nature. So that said, through the creativity of our mind and our spiritual efforts, our identity may become rooted in something much deeper, something that is beyond the mind and much more authentic, something that fully transcends all beliefs. Kabir said, "Just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things and stand firm in that which you are." By most, but not all accounts, it requires effort to recognize our true nature. Often, it's a matter of making it important enough in our lives. Life demands our attention. We're just drawn out and scattered in so many different ways. So we need to find the ways and means each day to redirect our attention to our spiritual lives. And in that vein, to find the greatest treasure of all, I offer the following navigation tools that were helpful to me. And these tools are oriented toward an overall attitude rather than specific tasks or specific approaches. And of course, my greatest hope is that one of these tools will inspire you. So in no particular order, love of truth. For me, when I read Richard Buckey's book, I think I was about 22 years old, Cosmic Consciousness, that that just blew me away. It took me by storm. There's people talking about their spiritual discoveries, their realizations, and I just was so sucked in. I wanted that. And it just contains a lot of different stories about insight and enlightenment. And that was the spark. That was the spark in the very beginning. You might experience or project love onto a teacher, and if, especially if you're heart-oriented. And, you know, I've told the story before, I won't go too much into it, but I was a guy that was lived here. And until I found a teacher that blew open my heart, I didn't realize the whole bhakti side. It made no sense to me how love could even play a role in this endeavor. And I think I'm just so deeply rooted here now. I just can't imagine how I was so locked in my head at one point. But love is the thing that opened me. And you might find love if you feel into the preciousness of it. I don't mean that it's all pleasant, but it's an amazing thing. Us sitting here, this transformation, this body, this nervous system, takes what I would call nothingness and makes it everything. So we are a miraculous transformer between heaven and earth. And too many of us don't turn love on ourselves. And I don't mean propping ourselves up as the center of the universe. We have enough of that. We sometimes are too hard on ourselves. We divide ourselves by having ideas that we should be thinking, feeling, doing something spiritual, while another part of us judges the inadequacies of our efforts. So we're fractured, we're highly fractured. We fear love. In enlightenment, that love falls away. And love becomes an unimaginable, impersonal, capital L love that unconditionally accepts everything. Curiosity and desire. Arne and I did not compare notes before this, so there's a couple overlaps. What I thought about when you were talking about how desire can be a distraction, Rose often talked about milk from thorns. So taking something that might be a thorn and using it on this path, turning it around on yourself and using it as a tool. So we can turn our curiosity towards spiritual matters and discover something beyond the beliefs we've held onto all our life. We can have a deep desire to change our life by examining personal convictions and spiritual beliefs we hold most closely. Said another way, we can open to the possibility that our beliefs are wrong. And it's possible that a strong desire for a radical shift in perspective is actually conducive to protecting us when our worldview is shattered in enlightenment. And so what I mean by that, I think one of the items I'll talk about later is patience, but we all want this thing so fast. We want to rush into it. We want this thing called enlightenment. And to me, this constant looking at your mind over time kind of whittles you down slowly in a compassionate way. So when everything is stripped away, it's not so destabilizing. So if, that's what I was saying before about becoming deeply rooted in something real. This looking brings you closer and closer to the thing you're looking for. And to be rooted in it when everything is shattered leaves you grounded. And what I mean by that, Rose often said there are a lot of enlightened people in the nut house, basically, because they've been destabilized. They may have seen something that they weren't ready for. Our desire can manifest as an overall intention for life. In fact, we can start each day by giving words to that intention. Life will form a center of gravity around that intention. And many of us desire immortality. In enlightenment, we largely lose the fear of death. What a relief. So pretty much every talk I give, friendship is a big one. And in his essay, I think, Art, you just sent something around that caught my eye. Totally forgot about it. That was in the forum. The essay Man. And Richard Rose said in that essay, "There is no treasure so great as a true friend." He said, "In order to gauge that path or even our very sanity, we need the eyes of a trusted friend. And when we find a path out of a deep feeling of gratitude to friendship, we try to bend down and help another so that the chain of friendship may in itself be a type of immortality." So we can find our spiritual friends who are interested in exploring this journey. And in my life, it wasn't, you know, the traditional teacher had their role, but my TAP friends were my greatest teachers. And as I mentioned, you can find a lot of what I've written about on friendship. I think it's in the essay section on searchwithin.org, which is my website. Faith. We can have implicit faith and trust in the teacher. That said, we should never cede our own authority to another person. So I really strongly advocate balance in that area as someone who's been through it with personal experience. We can have faith in ourselves. We can have faith in our ability to find the truth. Rose said, "You have to doubt everything but your ability. If you doubt your ability, you won't try." We can trust life to give us what we need on this path. And this was a hard thing for me. I think Bart, he takes it to an extreme more or less and says, you're getting what you need every minute, every day of your life. And I'm amazed at the serendipity in my life, just how teachers appear, things appear all the time at the right moment when they were necessary for me. Determination. So, you know, we're looking for this goal, enlightenment, and it's not going to come around to us. We're not going to drift into it unless we have a strategy. So we can have a strategy in place that orients our entire life around this. This is what we want. So the other thing I would say with that, though, I'm sure everybody that talks this weekend is going to say, we can give you help, but you need to make it your own. You need to figure out what it is that hits you, what you can experiment with. And we can become our own authority instead of relying too heavily on teachers as a crutch. When I was around, and everybody that was around Rose just leaned on him so heavily. I know I waited around for the zapping. You know, I was just going to hang out with the guy until the right moment. I was going to sit in a rapport sitting, and boom, you know, I would get hit with something, and that would be the end of it. When he disappeared from the scene, which was a blessing to all of us, I realized that the crutch had been kicked out from under me. And we can carve time or out time in our lives and use whatever means necessary to find an authentic teacher. We can spend time alone. We can spend time in isolation or group retreats. And this is where, be determined in those areas. We can just be determined to come back to the idea of just waking up a couple of times during the day, like at key moments, just idle times. Step out of the mind even if it's for a moment or two during key opportunities through the day. So the enemy of determination is hopelessness. It's one of the biggest obstacles that most seekers face. And we can have the determination just to keep going in the face of that. Again, this is where your spiritual friends can really help. You know, they can pick you up when you're down, and vice versa. we should recognize that we're human. We'll all make mistakes, no doubt about it. And it's okay to be flawed, in my opinion. There's no other alternative. And in many cases, a deeply sincere seeker fails his or her way to truth. This is the common theme, and it's definitely a part, it's been a theme in my life. I tried everything and failed at everything until, for some reason, surrender was given to me. So, patience. We can allow the path to unfold at its own pace. But again, don't let the idea of coasting get into your head about this. That's not what I'm talking about. We can find the edge between pushing too hard or just letting things happen on their own. And Rose called it running between the raindrops. And certainly a big thing with TAT is watching your mind. Being, in Rose's term, a process observer. So the process of redirecting our attention is like being an artist or a sculptor or any skill that you want to be exceptional at. With time, in this case, the act of bending our attention back on itself gets easier and stronger the more we apply ourselves. And lastly, we can have patience with all our follies and ourselves, you know. If you have too much pride, this might not apply, but I say be kind to yourself at times. It's the right attitude to hold. Acceptance and gratitude. We can accept circumstances presented to us at every minute. And again, this isn't laying back and coasting. That's not what I'm talking about. We can trust in this idea of acceptance. Rose said that once the commitment is made to find your capital T truth at all costs, some interior or anterior self sets up protection. It may even set up the whole path. Of course, he also said that we shouldn't get too secure in this because it does seem like despair is part of the formula. And most of us fear life. In enlightenment, we largely lose the fear of life by finding the edge between fighting like hell and not giving a damn. Between having direction in life and giving up control. This is the real genius behind Rose's idea of betweenness. We can have gratitude for everything in our life. If you think about all the good and bad events that could have happened in your life that brought you where?
Here.
Right here. Humility. We can turn away from taking credit for all that is occurring around us. And this means relinquishing the idea of trying to micromanage our life. You know, that's what we want to do. If I can get my shit together, then I can do the spiritual work. So I'll try to manage all the little things that are happening. And that also applies in here. Trying to micromanage all the thoughts and feelings. And that's where the humility plays a part as a formula. And we can certainly laugh at ourselves. I always find that a great antidote when I'm doing something stupid. And laugh with others. Especially if your humor involves puns. I find that humor to me humility to me keeps me open to new discoveries. I mean, if I said I had all the answers, what purpose would there be? So it keeps me open to new things about life, about reality, about this guy called Phil. You know, I'm always finding out new things about myself that I didn't know before. And the last, is self-honesty. If we watch our mind, we can recognize how one part of us fools the other part. This was, again, another part of Richard Rose's system. We can see our rationalizations for not taking action, have all kinds of reasons why I shouldn't do this, or all kinds of reasons why I should do this, or improper action. We know we're doing something wrong, and we still do it. We can hear the voices that want our attention, but these are often flawed and usually reveal themselves in the form of regret. The more clarity we develop, the more you go inward, away from the reverse vector, the retreat from untruth, the more clarity, the more likely you'll be honest with yourself. So, in closing, I offer the following poem from Hafez. He was a 14th century Islamic poet. And here goes. I ruminate on God and my old self. I'm amazed I got this far and held it together. A lot of this is, the things that have happened to me are relatively recent, so. Yeah, the only negative part about tears is you can't communicate. I'll try it again. It was the second line that got me. I ruminate on God, and my old self falls away. Am I a Christian, a Hindu, a Muslim, a Buddhist, or a Jew? Do not know for truth, capital T, has set fire to these words. Now they are nothing but ashes. I ruminate on God, and my old self falls away. Am I a man, a woman, an angel, or even a pure soul? I do not know, for love, capital L, has melted these words away. Now I am free of all these images that haunted my busy mind. Take questions.
What's happening when you write this letter?
I've completely disintegrated before even this moment. And it's hard to It just evokes the falling apart again. I did my old days as doing presentations for business for government. I know better to always try to do a dry run. I did it in upstairs this morning, and I was in tears the whole time. So it was great that I got to the end of them being in tears.
That was the wet run.
Yeah. I can always count on Ricky. Because I love humor. I always give awards out for the best humor.
Put a sticker and wear the medal, probably. Most humble.
Yeah. I said before, it's an amazing journey. And the tears, they're not tears of sadness. Tears of gratitude. But that's the beauty of it. And tears of love too. It was in the book.
Yeah. Oh, in this book?
Yeah.
Huh? Well, what age did this poet live in?
14th century.
14th century.
I don't know if I said that right. Is that Hafez? Does anybody know?
Hafiz.
You say Hafez, I say Hafiz. Yes. And I don't remember reading anything anywhere else, but I found that the contrast was, here is a book of science, and the guy has said, you know, he's had an enlightenment experience, and he put that poem in there. There's a lot of different experiments in the back of the book. Some of them sound real corny to me, so, you know, take that with a grain of salt. But a lot of my paths kind of just made sense of what was happening here. And I was hoping Bob would ask me a question about meditation.
You know, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. here's my take on meditation. I might have a slightly different angle with some of the other TAT teachers. Up until 3 years ago, my sense of meditation more or less was walking meditation. I agree with Arnima. There's something about energizing the whole body and going out for a walk with yourself and just letting things come up around. The intention, of course, would be around this, not just to think about work or something else, but think about, what am I doing in life? Am I following a path? What do I need to do to find this answer? So that would be the intention on the start of the walk. And I did that for like 30 years. And it served me well, and I still do it today. You know, like when I go to put a presentation together, first Art asks me to do it, and I say, shit, yes, I'll do it. And then I gotta get up in front of everybody. But then I came up with these 9 words. And I'm out walking, and I started to put meat on the words. You know, my whole mind coalesces around the ideas. I add little things, first of all, then I have a skeleton, then suddenly I have a full-fledged presentation, a full-fledged paper. So that's one practical example of walking meditation. And then 3 years ago, I got into a practice of sitting. And of course, like anything you do, you go to the experts first. So you find out, What do they do? What are they talking about with meditation? And I started with that, but then this is the thing. For all of us, we have to take the pieces of information that seem relevant to us and make it our own. So I would sit and meditate, and over time, this is 6 months, a year, I started to see these are the things that work for me, and these are the things I discarded. So my form of meditation now is at the beginning to use some what I would call artificial tools to settle the mind body down. Just get settled down. You know, you could even use what you want. You could use somebody else's guided meditation, but you can find your own techniques. Get a little distance from your mind. So you know, this whole thing about the watcher, the viewer, the witness, observer, there's something watching, something deep in us that feels like us, feels like some sense of concrete observer looking out at thoughts and feelings. They become in our view. So if you settle down and start that process, you get distance from your thoughts and feelings, you can then allow those to arise. And again, at the beginning of a meditation, sit down with the intention that I don't want to think about work. I don't want to think about having to take the garbage out. I want to think around this very topic. Then you start to see what you're made out of. So to me, if you want to know what makes you tick, you need to get distance in a period of meditation and watch what comes up. So what's getting your attention in that period of silence? And that's what I mean by the answer to your question, disintegrating. You start to see what you thought was a coalesced self is a bunch of thoughts and feelings flowing by that have it. To me, what you're looking for is a space between that. So the content doesn't matter, actually, in most regards. I'd say 90% of what's flowing in front of you is just old, is debris. It's old thoughts, old patterns, memories, which is fine. You know, you don't push it away. You don't latch onto it and get on the thought train and go. You're just kind of watching the substance of you. And what you're trying, what is meant by backing away is you're trying to back into the substance in which thoughts and feelings arise. And by some accident, I don't know what, that idea of an observer or some concrete thing in you that's watching gets shattered. And you realize what you've been looking for is everywhere. It's presenting itself to you. It's life, consciousness, it's awareness soup, to use Bart's term, I think. It's the merging of awareness, this intrinsic thing you cannot miss. Only spiritual seekers can make this so difficult. That's sort of what happens. It becomes a complex thing when you step back and you say, my God, what have I been looking for? It is here. It can never not be here. So the idea of meditation to me is to back into that further and further and dissolve self. Not that self is bad. That's the thing that I would call the last leg of the scaffolding for me. You know, this idea of seeking is like a, you know, we're propped up on scaffolding and we go by one at a time. We're chopping one leg off at a time and the scaffolding getting shaky. The last one for me was self-doubt. And by self-doubt, I mean, I had these ideas about enlightenment. So I was comparing myself to this teacher and that teacher and that teacher. And again, it's so unique to each person. That's a really bad approach. And that's what caused the self-doubt. And when that self-doubt crumbled, I was left with the realization that it's such a very simple, obvious answer that I looked past something that was right here. Closer than close.
I'm just curious about self-honesty thing, because I used to really worry about what's your yardstick for, how do you know you're being self-honest?
By making mistakes. So when I said the voices in my head that would tell me to do something and I followed it, not knowing whether that was a valid voice or a true voice. And usually I got kicked in the teeth because often there's something telling you, you really shouldn't do that, or you really should do it or not do it, and you discard that. And you still follow the voice and you find out, okay, that was a dumb move. I think it comes from watching the voices argue. Watching the voices argue with themselves. And again, I think it may not completely answer your question, but it seems like the more you do this, the more skilled you get at it, and it just starts to align much, much better. So, another example. Yeah, the idea of we're always fooling ourselves. And here's a really good example of personal experience. What started to happen to me at the end was, let me step back. So in 2007, as I usually describe my path, my head had blown off. It was basically following Richard Rose's system. I was dropped into that, and everything was stripped away. But I likened it to the deepest experience possible, but still mind came back. And so the sheer simplicity of what I saw as a result of that experience could not be accepted, and the mind kept throwing old beliefs and old patterns back. And so the process of dissolving was seeing through those beliefs. Like, the belief would come up that, no, you're not done, Phil. You know, because this teacher said enlightenment is like this. And so the belief would come up, and just by stepping back and seeing it, it was like, well, is that true? I would ask myself, is that true? And eventually those beliefs start crumbling. Like, what is the basis of that? That makes no sense. And so the beliefs, the self-honesty to me is seeing beliefs and not believing in them anymore. It's like, oh, I've seen you before. You know, I've seen you before. You don't serve me, you old thought pattern, you know. So they just sort of die away. And what I feel is happening, you know, for those of you scientifically inclined, I think by the neural patterns in the brain, in a way, get de-energized because you're not serving them anymore. You're not having these old thoughts over and over and over. So when you see through them, perhaps those neural patterns just die away. And you'll become like a little child. The brain of a little child is wide open. You know, it doesn't have all the old conditioning, the old thought patterns. And that always mystified me. What do you mean, become like a little child? And to me, it's like, well, those old beliefs are seen through because, yeah, I was being self-honest. Brett?
Yeah, I have a question about that book. Is that best for describing what the experience is, or is it best for figuring out how to get there? What would you say is the thrust of the book?
Yeah, thanks for actually asking that, because the title of the book implies that, oh, once you're enlightened, this is how the brain's changed. But what I find about the book is like the TAT idea of staring at your mind and having these little insights along the way. These things are greasing the skid for the big E enlightenment. He calls them little E enlightenments. So, you know, the crazy thing, I would look at all these spiritual paths and say, why would somebody do drumming? And, you know, it's like stuff that's way out there. But he actually explains what's happening. So all the different nuances, all the different things that captivate different people are greasing the skids for an awakening. And so, yeah, I mean, it's actually showing scientifically by scans in the brain what these centers are. I think Gary Weber was here and he said the centers of the brain, the frontal lobe, and he went like this, the parietal lobe back here. These are the things that tends to calm down because it's language, and that makes sense to me. All this negative inner chatter that we have, that starts to break down, and the blood flow isn't nearly as much up here in a state of enlightenment or a state of realization, or as you're going through this process of looking inward, that's calming down a bit. And I couldn't describe exactly what he says, but at the moment of enlightenment, he says it is like a dramatic drop in one part of the brain. It just drops like 20%, he said, and stays there. So, I mean, you can take some of this with a grain of salt. As always, science has its limitations. The one thing I didn't like about this book, and this is my, you know, irritation, just, again, one of the geniuses of Richard Rose's system, is there's a pitch in here for a CD. And for, you know, for $249.99, you can buy this CD, which gives you techniques to facilitate enlightenment. And in the back, though, he does freely give a lot of exercises to help grease the skids, as he would say.
Maybe I'm saying that those who say don't know and those who know don't say. Maybe it's like the brain, if the thought machinery is down here, when you're down there, you're not articulating all these words, but when you're articulating, your brain maybe isn't quite down there.
Yeah, even the idea of a state of enlightenment implies some, you know, if we get to concoct these ideas of bliss or something shuts down permanently, but yeah, stuff still happens in the mind. Is great. I'm like, the mind is a great tool, but it has its limitations. So,
does he ever suggest in any even hint that people that they believe that somewhere down the road is an enlightenment pill?
No, nothing like that.
Because if it's all, you know, brain chemistry, we could do this to the brain, it would generate that same end result in terms of the experience.
Actually, really good point. Mark, you had a question?
Yeah, you were talking about the scans that they do. Is it just before and after, or is it while it's happening?
I think both. Some of the experiments, they're fMRI, and they would do it during certain exercises, but then I believe scanning, I don't know whether it was like 100 people who claimed to have enlightenment experience, that they would scan them, not having them doing anything in the MRI itself, just, you know, in other words, part of it was to actually do exercises while they were being scanned, and another part was just don't do anything, just, you know, we're going to scan the brain. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, because you said something in the acceptance and gratitude part. Despair is part of the formula. Can you talk about that?
Oh my gosh. So he asked about acceptance, gratitude, and despair.
Because you said despair is part of the formula.
Yeah. And that was expressed in failing my way to truth. I was just so despaired over 30 years of seeking, so desperate. You can't concoct that, you can't generate that, but it tends to happen when you are just so desperate, so thirsty for truth, that despair will be there. I don't know if I answered your question, but it is a little tricky when I use the word acceptance in a way. The final surrender is nothing that, you know, you could say none of it was your own doing, but to me what really felt palpable was the final surrender was done for me. And there is, I don't know what awareness is. I don't know what this intelligence is, but I do feel that intelligence knows exactly what is right for you without giving it too much emphasis, because you can see how you can flip that around and say, okay, I'll just hang back here, drink a beer on the couch, and let the intelligence do its work. That's not it either.
I feel like, I mean, personally, I've experienced the kind of despair, but even before I knew I was on a path. So I don't know. Yeah, I'm still working it out, but I mean, I'm asking. So.
Well, life itself is a path of despair. Right. I've said this in the past. Most people come into this because they're suffering or they're just having a hard time in life. I don't know what the percentage is. They're repelled. Life has kicked them in the teeth, so they're repelled into the spiritual path. There's another percentage, a smaller percentage. And I would put myself in this camp. It wasn't like I had a really bad life. I mean, life wasn't that bad. I had my moments and things, but I just loved the search for reality. It was like, so one is pushing me back into the search. The other is, give me this. I want this. You just step into it totally. So that might not have been so much despair. Maybe that was the bait I took in the beginning. You know, like I said, it was bait and switch. But at some point, my suffering was seeker suffering. That's what it was. I generated my own suffering because I wanted this so bad. And I just couldn't figure it out.
Do you think that suffering, that seeker suffering is helpful?
Yeah, it's like everything coalescing around this, my whole life coalesces around it. Working with Tat, you know, doing things for other people, ladder work, as Rose called it. So, you know, all that is energy applied in this, you know, not this way, but more or less in reverse, but it's energy applied, application of energy.
So you mentioned that, I think where you put it was, there's an intelligence that knows what's best for you. You don't know what it is, and then you said, you know, that's not an excuse to take your feedback kind of thing. Is that intelligence, is that, and I'll struggle for words for the best way to say this, but is that what feels like your identity now? Do you feel like that is you?
Yeah. What you're looking for, as I said in the beginning, it's intrinsic, and you can't, as a human being, it's there. All you're doing is peeling away the onion to see that is your true identity. And then you realize it's not here, it's not here. It is everywhere. You know, it sounds trite. I am already that. You know, what's the other ones? I am one. There's all these trite sayings for it, but you realize that that intelligence can't be perceived, you can't touch it, you can't smell it, you can't. It's by direct contact, by a direct knowing, that intelligence you know then is everywhere and permeates in you like you become saturated with it.
Is that what you meant when you said, I don't know what it is, but right. It's because it has no attributes to know?
Yeah. Yeah, I just know it by, like right now, I just know it by its mere presence. You know, like in our retreat session, awareness resting as awareness. And being comfortable with the fact that the mind, you know, has thoughts and feelings and all that stuff is arising and falling away, just like a bird flying through the space, through our space, the wind blowing through our tree, through a tree. It's all the substance, awareness soup. That's the intelligence. Maybe one more question. Thank you. Wait.